Welcome back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined by Ty Zanders, because, Ty, it is September 2nd as we record this, September 3rd as people are listening to it, and there has been so much activity in the college lacrosse recruiting landscape since the last time we recorded. It was necessary for us to get on a podcast again and catch up. How are you doing? I would imagine that the days have been long over the last couple weeks.
Absolutely, yeah. So doing well, man. Just happy that we're back. I mean, it's always recruiting season, but in terms of commitment season, we're certainly in that right now. And I think that it's just been a blast. Just reaching out to different people and seeing what's going on, the offers that are on the table. But just blown away that we're already in the month of September. And just pumped for what's ahead, man.
So we recorded on the heels of the Inside Lacrosse Invitational Session 3 in early August, and the second half of August was unusual, as the entire summer and spring was, on the basis of the fact that activity didn't really ramp all the way down the way it traditionally does. Obviously, with the ongoing dead period, the fact that college coaches were not on sidelines didn't make much of a difference in terms of rescheduled events trying to take place. In addition to that, as many clubs as possible tried to stick to their typical time frame for hosting tryouts for the following fall and summer, spring and summer, depending on whether it was a youth or a high school age club team. And then obviously the ramp up in terms of preparation, both for rankings and first contact, meant that you were on the phone a ton with college coaches. How do you characterize the last couple of weeks of August since we last caught up?
Definitely a blur. I think that just always try and just take a few days to myself after finishing the last event, which was our Inside Lacrosse Invitational Session 3, and laid low, went to the beach for a little bit, and then just, as you mentioned, just kind of caught up on some film and some highlights and a lot of conversations and got a lot out of that. But definitely a blur. I felt like, obviously these last 6 months have been hectic and have flown by, but I thought August in particular, all of a sudden, just boom, it's 9-1. But I think it was enjoyable just getting different perspectives from coaches on maybe what they saw happening with all this recruitment. And I think we've gotten to the point now where everyone's kind of just feeling like, all right, this could go a lot quicker than we originally thought. And I think that I started to feel more that way based on conversations with coaches around the 19th or 20th, and that kind of just push me to really get more and more acquainted with kids I hadn't seen live this summer. So, very hectic, but just enjoyable always to have those conversations, because that's a huge part of what I do. And, I think just a lot of different opinions, knowing that you're watching on film versus in person. So that's, certainly an interesting component.
And we made the decision as an Inside Lacrosse staff to restructure the way that we were going to roll out all of this recruiting content over the course of days, weeks, months, and both online and in the magazine. And so the decisions were made that we would essentially take what is traditionally our recruiting issue and break that content across three or more issues. So the decision was that we are going to include content about the class of 22 in our traditional October issue, which is getting sent to the printer more or less as we speak. And then subsequent to that, we are going to do our women's recruiting issue, which will be focused predominantly on the class of 2020. And then subsequent to that, we will have an equivalent issue that'll be focused predominantly on the men's class of 2020. And we made these decisions because, first and foremost, with respect to the class of 22, the lack of familiarity compared to prior years meant that there was this push-pull. You just laid out the fact that there are going to be a lot of players committing, but at the same time, the ability to do a top 100 wasn't necessarily as easy or prudent or realistic as in prior years. And so on August 31st, you rolled out a top 10, and then the following day on September 1st, rolled out the remainder of your five stars, which is 12 players comprising the top 22 players in the class, and currently working on rolling out the four stars subsequent to that. And then we'll revisit the Power 100 for the incoming freshmen in subsequent weeks. And then with respect to ranking the entirety of the class of 22 and the class of 2021, that'll be something that'll happen after more fall lacrosse takes place. So with that table being set, can you just walk through what it was like trying to develop the five stars and really make the distinction in that threshold of, you know, a couple guys here, a couple guys there, but ultimately these were the decisions that we made?
Yeah, it was pretty difficult. And I think that, you know, in terms of building the top 10, I don't think that was that hard, despite the lack of, you know, the lack of lacrosse relative to the past. But it's obviously splitting hairs when you get into that, you know, 5 through 10, you can even say 5 through 22. And that's why I made this decision. But yeah, it was definitely difficult, but, you know, felt really confident in identifying those guys and kind of having that backed up and vetted by college coaches, you know, and some relationships of people that I trust when it comes to evaluation. So, you know, pretty pumped about that list. I think that it was interesting in particular. I think just bouncing off, you know, Don Petromal and Joey Spolina's name and having, you know, off coaches and having close to an even split in terms of who they'd go with at number one. So I think, as mentioned in the write-up, it'll be really enjoyable and, you know, interesting, especially given their, you know, closely knit relationship, just to see Dom and Joey, you know, just trade blows and, you know, Dom try and take over number one spot in the next couple of years. But, you know, those are very easily the top two players. But, yeah, I mean, a fun process as always. And to reiterate, I think that it's so crucial for me to emphasize this. I mean, this list of five stars is not done yet. And, you know, right now we have 22, and that's what, you know, that's a component that I love about the starring process, is that it varies from year to year. I said to someone the other day that, you know, the number 27 player in this class to me is much better than the number 27 player in, say, the 21 class or the 19. It's not always an even ranking. So I think that's the measure of a class, is the amount of five stars. And I expect to get somewhere between 25 and 30 later this fall with more evaluations and some of these injured players coming back, you know, from injury.
So as you continue to move throughout that list, you know, one of the things that I think is so interesting about how you structure this process is what you want a five-star to mean. And so for our listeners who haven't heard you describe it before, can you just explain what a five-star is in your eyes?
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's no doubt that I feel like there's a cutoff, and I want a five-star to, you know, really have minimal flaws in their game. You know, these guys are gonna make mistakes, but, you know, and I always say 9 times out of 10, I want to be, you know, impressed by a five-star talent. And, you know, I think going back to the earlier point, that's why I was on the fence with a lot of these guys that, you know, 4s, 4.5, 5, it's hard to know. I thought there are 5 or 10 guys that I looked at pretty hard, but had certain aspects about their game that just barely, you know, held them back. And like we said, we'll get there in the fall. But, you know, in terms of just a five-star and what that looks like on field, it's someone that athletically and skill-wise and IQ is just dialed in every sense, and consistency is, you know, so important as well. And of course, just, you know, backing that up with college coaches and knowing the guys they feel most confident in throwing big money at, throwing scholarship offers at, you know, from the ACC and Big Ten. And then obviously, you know, I'm sure some Ivy League guys in there as well. So, you know, I think that's what I look for a five star to be, just a tremendous athlete, tremendously skilled, tremendously intelligent. You know, that's a five star.
And for me, one of the things that really stands out is the consistency, which is one of the elements of this summer that was difficult. There was seemingly an inordinate or disproportionate number of players who were injured, including your number 3 ranked player, Joey Terenzi, a middie from Long Island Express in Manhasset, who missed the summer recovering from an elbow injury.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that leads me into a point. I appreciate you for setting me up there, you know, but I think that I was a little bit more, you know, despite what I said, I think a little bit more lenient and understanding, you know, in terms of that consistency, because of the lack of spring. I felt like that affected, you know, some bad habits or consistency, whatever it was. So, I mean, nothing was normal this summer, and nothing was traditional in terms of the way that everyone and the way that I went about this. But, you know, I did feel like it was a different process for sure. But felt really confident just with the amount of film that was at our disposal, the amount of events that I could attend, and also just, you know, trusting evaluations from the past, knowing that a player like Joey Terenzi or Tayden Boltman or Henry Caponitti, I think that's all three that were injured, knowing those guys really hadn't played since either the fall or last summer, and going back to those, the events that they played in last year.
Moving on down the list, number four is Truett Sunderland, and it's interesting to consider him alongside number one and two because those three guys comprised an attack line at Juniors Open, which was essentially the first event of this summer, which you attended in Tennessee in late June, early July.
Yeah, I mean, that lacrosse there on that team red attack was just preposterous. And having those three together, and then, you know, same with, Team Slancha, up at the North American Invitational in Pennsylvania. So, you know, seeing those three and kind of comparing them against each other, you know, I think you had a lot of college coaches kind of talking about them in the same breath, ripping apart their, the pros and cons about their game. But yeah, I mean, Truett's outstanding. I think he's more of the traditional quarterback than, Petromal and Spallina, you know, and with Terenzi being that, you know, killer of a midfielder out of Manhasset. Sunderland is just, yeah, definitely more of a traditional attackman. I don't think a Steele Stanley comparison is a perfect one, but just, that stereotypical MIAA, smart, crafty attackman. And I think that despite his lack of size relative to the others, I think he makes it work for him, and it's just tough as nails. And is someone that, you know, I know schools like, Virginia or Maryland and others will be all over, and they already are. So it'll be interesting to see where those guys end up. And as we mentioned, I can see maybe two of them ending up on the same, in the same recruiting class with that particularly being Petromal and Spallina.
The last guy I want to talk about in the top 10 is Adam Blind, a goalie from Columbus who attends Culver Military Academy and plays for Resolute. But one of the contexts in which I want to bring him up is you made a decision to include birth month in your five-star listings is in an effort to increase transparency. And it sparked a conversation about how substantial or impactful age is in player development. What did you take away from the spread of ages among the players that you ranked, and how impactful do you think it is, particularly for guys once they get to be 16 or 17 years old?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. This is a topic that I feel like we could talk about for hours and bring people on and discuss because, I always feel like the DOB matters. And that's one of the first things I try and gather, when I'm putting together an Excel and my big board, because I really do believe that, it gives context to players' development. And Blind is someone that, one, I think he's just off the charts. Both as a player and as a kid, and I think that he will be in college, and that's the way he went with him. And I'm sure there are some people that may be trying to take away from someone who was born in October 2002, and he did that at Culver after transferring in from his public school in Ohio, and that's something that as you and I discussed, and you told me something that you were recently told by Culver in terms of how they do it. Am I correct that you said that 2 years? You have to transfer in and do 2 years of Culver. Is
three,
that correct?
Three. You cannot three? Transfer in and only do two.
Exactly.
Correct. Yeah. Yep. So
exactly.
Once. So
exactly.
If you want to arrive, you have to be there for 3 years.
Yep. Yep. So I think that that gives context in itself, and I think that Blind is someone who is a 21 or was a 21 and. Played with the 21s in Maverick Showtime last year and was an all-star and was just terrific. And I feel like it's the steadiest guy. But, being an October 2002 guy, he's the oldest kid in the top 10. But, otherwise, I really don't make too much of a big deal out of some of the other birth dates. I don't think that there's that distinct of a separation in months, with Spallina being June 2003 and Petromal being September 2003, right on 9-1. And then you look at someone like Terenzi and it's January 2004. He's the youngest of the top 10. I always kind of feel like, maybe fall, early winter is an average birthday, maybe somewhere around Thanksgiving 2003. You know, that's just a rough ballpark. But I do think this has all, you know, sparked some interesting, you know, conversation. And I've enjoyed just going down my Excel spreadsheet and looking at those DOBs, because there's some kids that I knew had some upside, and you can tell they're just putting it together. And it's intriguing to look back and see, okay, wow, this is a mid spring or late spring birthday in 2004. You know, there's room to grow there and develop because they're younger in the class. And, you know, I've got to, you know, forgive me for using this quote for the millionth time. It feels like these last few weeks having this conversation with coaches and yourself, you know, Buck Showalter, my guy, former manager of the Orioles and a number of other teams, you know, used to always say, you know, you don't want to draft an 18-year-old pitcher with the full beard, you know, be out of high school, because that means that, you know, he's maybe you've seen their growth, you know, he's peaked, you know, and they won't, you know, grow and develop, you know, that much more physically and athletically. So I think that's something that I always, you know, tie back to the age debate, which there certainly is one on Twitter these days.
Yeah, I tend to agree with your decision to include it, primarily because I don't see much reason not to. But my point of view is that the spread of 12 months or anything beyond 12 months matters a lot more when you're younger, and it matters less and less as you get older. And that's part why, you know, in high school, the typical grade spread for most sports is, you know, 1 or 2 years, right? So, you know, most freshman sports are just for freshmen. JV tend to be for freshmen and sophomores, maybe a few juniors, and then varsity is for seniors, juniors, and then the best sophomores. And then when you get to college, there's no JV, so everybody's competing together in a 4-year swath. And it's because as you get older, the range of athletic development narrows on the basis of age, right? It's not to say that there's none, and it's also not to say that everybody's the same. That's not the case. But my point is that when you're young, say you're in fourth grade and you're 10 years old, there's a big difference between the average development across 18 months that is much wider than when you're 16 or 17 years old. And so that's kind of the first point. And then the second point is, I think one of the reasons it becomes a hot button topic is because it's a relatively, I don't want to say it's a victimless scapegoat, but the issue of reclassifying is a systemic issue that people are opposed to, and it allows you to be opposed to it without necessarily having to call someone out by name. Now, obviously, in specific instances like what we talked about with Blind, you know, there are obvious reasons for making that decision, and I think we can all appreciate the idea that we are all responsible for our own best outcomes and making sure that we make the decisions that make the most sense for us and our families. And I don't think folks generally begrudge that. More so, is this a system-wide opportunity to try to gain an advantage? And I would argue, or to some extent assume, that, you know, for as many folks as reclassifying really advantaged, there were as many that it didn't make much of a difference for, right? They didn't take that extra year and really benefit from an athletic development standpoint. And so as a result, you know, it kind of comes back to, is when you make that decision, is this the right thing for the family? And obviously, when you're a lacrosse fan analyzing recruiting, of course, it's about how good is that player? How good does that player perform against his or her peers? And what is that player's upside potential? And all of those things are the responsibility of the coach to discern. So in the event that the coach knows how old the player is, then it shouldn't necessarily matter that much what, I don't know, the breadth of the competition pool is in terms of the age of the player. That would be my like main point.
Exactly. And I think, you know, I you couldn't have said any better. I mean, that was perfect. I think that
I'm sure I could have. I rambled a little bit in the middle of that, but I appreciate you bailing me out with that.
Yeah, no. And maybe if I got a little more sleep, I could, you know, get half as close to describing it, you know, as eloquently as you did. And I think it's such an interesting conversation to be had, because, you know, I do think that, you know, one of the reasons why I wanted to do it is because I think that there's, I don't know, certain areas and certain birth dates are both unknown and misunderstood. I think people are just making assumptions based on someone being dominant, or you know, hearing a rumor that that person was reclassed when they're really not. So I think just, you know, being transparent about it, you know, is something that I felt pretty strongly about. You know, but in reality, I think that it's really none of people's business. I think that it, just in terms of that why the decision was made, I think that you don't know whether it was because of learning disabilities or maybe something happened, you know, when they were younger, you know, that was traumatic and they decided to, you know, hold their kid back, you know, whatever it is. And certainly there are some people out there that may, you know, reclass their kid for an athletic advantage, but I don't think it's always, you know, as simple as that. You know, the bottom line is, yeah, you do what's best for your kid and your family and your kid's future. And you can't hate on that. You know, as much as people probably, you know, want to, but it's, you know, for the millionth time, just a fascinating, you know, conversation to be had. You know, they'll be ongoing as we hope to do it with the other classes as well. And, you know, down as we get to 4 stars and all that.
Well, let's transition to one of the reasons that you and I are both so fatigued. And that is that on Monday night from 5 p.m. to midnight, Inside Lacrosse hosted an inaugural boys club team event for 8 of the best groups in the class of 2022, and it featured among others, including the number 1 player in the class and the number 2 player in the class, who we already discussed, numbers I believe 8, 9, and 10, in addition to a couple other 5 stars as well. So basically what we did, right, if you remember from the last 2 years, we had an event called Midnight Mania, and that event was 88 players registering as individuals being put onto a team, being given a uniform and coaches. That event started at midnight because that was when the dead period ended. Division I coaches could come and coach, and the first contact was allowed. They would go through 2 20-minute practices and then play 2 games, and that was it. The event ended around 3 a.m. Last year, and at about 4 a.m. the year prior. We shaved a year off because we moved to a venue that had 2 fields. This year, because of the ongoing dead period, we knew that college coaches weren't going to be able to coach it. And so we kind of pivoted the concept, understanding that we can do Midnight Mania at a later date whenever the dead period ends and college coaches are once again allowed to coach. And instead, we hosted what essentially was a 8-team tournament called the Elite Eight. And it started with we selected the teams on the basis of our 2019 club ratings, just because they were done and we needed the lead time in order to be able to execute the event. And we seeded it accordingly. So the Annapolis Hawks were the number 1 seed. The DC Express was the number 8 seed. They played each other and the winner advanced. Now, the loser also played out their consolation bracket, and we ended up with standings of teams 1 through 8. But it was a really, really interesting experience just to watch teams show up and realize that our opportunity for winning a championship is dependent on what I do in the first minute of the first game, which is not a very common thing for most club tournaments. So Ty, the IL Elite Eight, what did you see unfold?
Yeah, I mean, it was hard not to smile, I think, just watching those games and having, you know, 8 fantastic teams, you know, right in front of our eyes. I think, you know, leading into 9-1, I think that it was an awesome experience in general. And, you know, there were some games that were, you know, pretty memorable, and I'm looking forward to watching. So, you know, I think just to have that amount of talent, you know, right in front of you, and it, you know, I think was pretty incredible. And I think that it was different, and it probably, you know, was a format that college coaches, you know, watching at home and others as well, you know, it maybe enjoyed better because of that chemistry and cohesion and, you know, the team aspect and, you know, just the compete level when you're playing for something. I think that's what's, you know, so important as well. So, I mean, I was blown away in many ways. I think that there were some times that there was some sloppy play to be expected, you know, after a brief, you know, break after the summer slowed down, but it was some really good lacrosse. And, you know, I felt like that Team 91 Maryland and Team 91 Long Island game was just one of the better games that I saw all summer. It was really, really enjoyable. I know that, you know, I know you feel the same way about it. So it was a blast, you know, from top to bottom. You know, definitely trying to catch up on some sleep after that. Always a tough one. I know you and I go back and forth about just, you know, it's tough because you get home and you're exhausted, but you're still, you kind of have this high, that makes it hard to go to sleep because of, you know, what just unfolded, you know, an hour and a half away back in Wilmington. But, you know, pretty incredible experience. I hope everyone had a blast. I know we did.
So just to kind of lay out how the event unfolded, as I mentioned, Annapolis Hawks took on DC Express in their first game of the event. Hawks emerged 7-3 victors. The number two seed, Team 91 Long Island Smash, topped Juice Cherries 12-8. The five seed, Sweet Lax, topped Primetime 11-7. And then the six seed, Team 91 Maryland Fire, beat the three seed, 3D New England Red, 12-9 in the opening round. So the semifinals were Hawks versus Sweet Lax and Smash versus Team 91 Maryland, as you said. And that Hawks Sweet Lax game was at one point looking like a blowout, and then Sweet Lax went on a great run. Hawks ended up winning 10-9. And then conversely, 91 Maryland built a big lead, I believe as big as 7-3 at one point, over Smash, really kind of catalyzed by Brock Behrman, a attackman from Niski Yuna. Smash went on a run and the game was tied at 7. Smash took an 8-7 lead. 91 Maryland answered, tied it at 8, then went ahead on a Charles Balsamo goal with 7 seconds to go to take a 9-8 lead. Joey Spallina scored with 1 second left in order to tie it at 9, and then Balsamo ended it with a goal to make it 10-9 in overtime, in order to send 91 Maryland into the championship against Hawks, where they were very much out of gas, and Hawks ran away, I believe, 15-3 victors for the championship. You hit the nail on the head. There were three or four really exciting games. I know Juice Cherries versus 3D New England in the consolation semifinals was another one that had a lot of excitement and drama in it. But that 91-91 matchup was absolutely a highlight festival and drama to spare.
Yeah, I mean, it really makes me want to see those two teams play. Let's get that going at a neutral site in Philly or something, you know, once a month these next few months, man. I mean, that was pretty enjoyable. And I think especially given that you had both teams playing, just like all the other squads there playing without a number of their better players, you know, for whatever reason. So, really enjoyed that one. I'm fired up for it to get back, get on Next Pro in full. And watch that film. So should be some film that's it got some pretty high view numbers. And I think that as I mentioned to someone yesterday, you really won't find a better consolation bracket in terms of the talent and the quality of the team than an Elite Eight. You know, I think it'll be fun to revisit.
So I mentioned Behrman. The other player who we can't talk about this event without mentioning was Hawks midfielder Paul Garza, who I believe had a hat trick in the semifinals and then maybe four goals in the championship. He was lights out, but just one of, dozens of players that got blown up as soon as September 1st hit.
Yeah, and he's someone who I think coaches were already high on, but I think that, and that's the important, point to make is that, coaches were really anticipating this event because whether it was a refresher or, maybe just like, I don't know. I think it wasn't like they were using the event to maybe increase a scholarship offer or a kid shooting up their board. But I think that Garza in a light, I think certainly helped himself and probably, had some coaches maybe second guessing, where he was on their board, because he was just terrific. I mean, just getting to the middle of the field for some quality shots and canning them, hard and accurate. I think he was one of the better players in attendance and was just, really, really consistent there. I loved watching him play. And, I thought Race Ripley and George Acton and Billy Dwan, Alex Ross. There are a lot of really talented players on that team, but all, highly impressive.
Well, Ty, we're recording this at 4:00 Eastern time on, as I mentioned, Wednesday, September 2nd, which means that we're 36, 40 hours into this September, post-September 1st world. Can you just summarize what has unfolded since midnight 2 days ago?
Yeah, I mean, the first commitment was Caden Whaling, a midfielder from, Rye, New York, and the Predators, club program. And he's someone that I could see on either side of the ball, potentially a defensive midfielder, highly athletic, big kid, pretty impressive whenever I saw him play this summer. So, you know, he was the first commit, and I think that we could see a few more ACCs. I think, you know, as I think I mentioned, you know, what's so interesting about this process is that, you know, relative to previous years is, you know, whereas usually you are going on these campus, you know, kids are going on these campus visits each weekend, or you know, hitting a few in one weekend that are in similar locations. This year, because of the dead period and limitations, you rather than getting that offer on their visit, you know, sitting in the coach's office with the parents, you're getting it right off the bat. And you know, I know that a ton of, you know, Big Ten and ACC offers are out, and you know, as well as other conferences as well. So I think that's a really interesting piece in this whole thing, and you know, one of the reasons why I do think this could move quicker than you know, than I thought it would originally. Just kind of just banging out those Zoom visits and tours, and getting building those relationships, and kind of having a good sense of where you want to go. You know, I think that's what, you know, why this year stands out, you know, relative to past years. So it'll be, you know, I have no idea what's going to happen. I just make a guess, have a hunch. But I do think that we will start to see these five stars and, you know, so-called high four stars will be rolled out soon, make decisions in these next you know, week or 2 weeks. But I think, it, you know, all in all, it's going to be the long game. A lot of coaches are on the fence about a lot of guys and need some time, some more film, and, you know, just to kind of figure out, you know, where these kids stand. I think everyone just needs more time, myself included.
So let's just dive a little bit deeper in that, because you said something that was really interesting, but I don't think a ton of people understood exactly or would be able to understand exactly what you were saying. So essentially, the way that recruiting works for this population that we're talking about, the top 50-ish, maybe a little bit more than that, players in a class, is they generally, depending on your academic profile, all get interest from roughly the same group of schools. And there's a need that if you're one of those 10 to 15 programs that wants to be, quote, in on that kid, you've got to get that kid on campus. And typically, the player is going to visit four or five schools. And oftentimes, because they can be geographically distributed and not infrequently, a player has, you know, plays football or something and has a game on Friday night, you know, he'll line up trips to four or five different parts of the country on successive weekends in September and October. And that's why, you know, we saw that timeline actually kind of hold true with a number of commitments being made, say, between October 15th and November 5th of last year in the class of 2021. And the reason that obviously that's not happening now is because you can't go visit. But one of the other elements of making that decision is, in an equivalency sport, it's not a binary offer, meaning I'm either going to offer you or I am not going to offer you, the way it is in football and basketball. The offer is more nuanced in the sense that typically it's a percentage of a scholarship, and oftentimes coaches would know immediately, and by immediately I mean, say, September 1st, what they would like to offer a player. Typically, they wouldn't share that information until the end of their visit, number one, as kind of decorum. I think it's just a little bit traditional. And number two, also to make sure that that's the carrot at the end of the visit in order to compel that player to come visit. Well, now in an environment where you can't do that, there's nothing preventing you from out the gate telling the player that you're interested in what you would be willing to offer. Is that kind of the way that you see it or understand it?
Yeah, in many ways. I think, you know, it's been, you know, interesting just asking some questions to college coaches and club guys and seeing how all this is unfolding. And I think that, you know, it seems to me that, you know, there's some situations out there where, you know, kids are now similar to the past in early recruiting, you know, kind of just being put on a deadline. You know, all right, we're offering you, but we need to know in 24 hours. We need to know in, you know, by Friday or the end of the weekend. I think that's starting to happen, which is something that, you know, usually I don't love, you know, but I think that just like everything else, I mean, nothing is normal right now. And I think that there's less spots and certainly less money to go around, because of, you know, schools maybe wanting to hold on for, hold out some money for a fifth-year transfer, you know, down the road, or their own guys and all that. So many moving parts, which is, you know, making things interesting here. I mean, we can definitely expect smaller classes, but also expect, I think just, I think plenty of kids out there that normally would get big time offers that are just, you know, so dead set on wanting to go to, you know, their dream school or one of their top schools that, their family is willing to bite the bullet and pick up a tab there. Obviously the ability to stack, need-based aid with athletic aid is huge and something that goes under the radar, as you and I have discussed, in the past. So many different factors that are making this just a wild process and something that we're pumped to kind of, report on over the course of the next few months.
Ty, 36 minutes into a 37-minute podcast, you dropped what is going to be or going to have to be the topic of further conversation because, yes, a recent NCAA rule change that modified the ability to combine financial aid, need-based financial aid with athletic aid is being implemented all across the country and certainly changing the dynamics at a really important time for a lot of different families and student athletes. And like whether it be birth dates or anything else, it is a conversation also for a later date. Caden Whaling to North Carolina got us off and running, and it is currently time to follow commitment season. As always, we appreciate your appearance on the IL Preps podcast. You can follow Ty on Twitter at Ty Zanders. I am at Terrence Foy. Follow at @inside_lacrosse and follow us on Instagram, @InsideLacrosse and IL_Preps. And we will be back next week with more Inside Lacrosse podcasts.